I want to welcome warmly to all of you for this, our first of the 2024 monthly MisTech webinars. Each month, we will bring you a webinar on a theme of interest, hopefully to you, but a theme of interest for the work of Anthroposophy in MisTech. Of course, your donations allow us to continue to bring you such events, and hopefully one day will allow us, that is MisTech, to realize some of the goals that Rudolf Steiner placed on those of us here in the West, namely the development of a healthy mechanical occultism. This webinar begins our new season. We are thrilled to have as our guest speaker today the former leader of the Biodynamic Association in North America, Robert Karp, who will speak not only tonight, but again next week at the same time. In February, we will have John Bird, who will take us into the life of John Dunlop, who, as a student of Steiner, initiated some very important worldwide initiatives on energy. Since I will be away on a speaking tour in March, we'll take a break in March, but MisTech will instead offer a mini conference on February 10th. We'll have speakers from the UK. Hey, it's only fair if an American gets to speak there that they get a chance to speak here. And then in April, Igor Nazarov will be our guest, and he'll speak about his work in a new field that we could say is roughly related to homeopathy. And don't forget about our annual conference during the Perseid meteor showers. That is April 8th to the 11th. This year's conference will be entirely online. Now, a moment ago, I mentioned MisTech's goal of a mechanical occultism, and that is one for a healthy human evolution. Next week, Robert will take up the theme of the three occultisms that Rudolf Steiner described, albeit briefly, in a lecture cycle called The Challenge of the Times. Today, we will set the background for that topic. So I want you all to put on that Daniel Boone hat, for we're about to explore the spiritual geography of North America that encompasses the mighty forces of both good and evil. Our exploration will journey into soul forces and elemental beings at work here. With such knowledge gained, we can help to bring healing to our troubled social and ecological landscapes. Now, our tour guide for this trek into the spiritual destiny of North America is known to most of us as Robert Karp, but Karp is actually a shortened version of the original surname, Karbelnikov. Did I come close?
Right. Yeah, you got it, man. You got it.
So what should we look for during this journey? Might there be a Parseval mystery embedded in the physical and etheric geography of North America? How can we cultivate the new etheric heart forces, which can help us to awaken and embody the good spirit of America? Robert is a perfect tour guide for us because of the many roles he has excelled at, such as an educator, a writer, and as a social entrepreneur. For many years, as the executive director of the Biodynamic Association, he was the face of sustainable agriculture in the U.S. As a writer, Robert's books include Toward an Associative Economy in a Sustainable Food and Farming Movement, also Social Justice in the Light of Anthroposophy, and a third, The Sacred Wound, Understanding and Responding to the Call of Grief, and lastly, Agriculture and the Sacred. So now, please join me in welcoming our tour guide, Robert, who comes to us from frozen Viroqua, Wisconsin.
Viroqua, you had it right the first time, Andrew.
Oh, okay.
Viroqua. Thank you. Thanks so much, Andrew. It's really
you.
An honor and a pleasure to be here with the MisTech community and with all the friends who gathered here. And I thought, you know, I've done this. I've done webinars, meaning I've rushed to finish the dishes, to sit down, or maybe sometimes I'm still doing the dishes or making a cup of tea. So I thought maybe we could just take a moment, even 10 or 15 seconds of stillness, to kind of presence ourselves here, put down the things you're holding or the things you've been rushing through to become present here. And just take a moment and feel your goodwill toward this community that's gathered here. Your feeling of gratitude for the opportunity to connect with this community, and also gratitude for these most unusual devices that allow us to gather in this way. Beautiful. So thank you again, Andrew. So I'd like to begin with an overarching thought that comes to us from esoteric Christianity, an insight that lives in esoteric Christianity, quite distinct from what lives in exoteric Christianity. And that is the awareness that the Christ being dwells in each of us in an utterly unique fashion through our individuality. And this fact that each of us presents an utterly unique expression, possibility for an utterly unique expression of the Christ impulse, is not only true of us as human beings, it's also true of particular places and particular landscapes. So this is why Rudolf Steiner referred to the farm also as the farm individuality. Every landscape, every place, we could even say every home, every neighborhood, has a distinct quality. And if we want to place our landscapes, our homes, our regions, our nations in the service of the Christ impulse, we need to penetrate into this unique individuality. And that's what we're going to be trying to do over these next two webinars, is to try to understand the unique character of North America, particularly North America, so that we can place ourselves in service to the christening of this landscape, of this place. So this webinar tonight, we'll be looking more at the spiritual geography of North America in the context of the whole world. We'll be looking at landforms through the lens of the human. And then next week, we'll be looking at these same mysteries through the lens of beings, of specific spiritual beings, and also through the lens of the three occultisms that Andrew just mentioned, eugenic, hygienic, and mechanical occultism. The other thing I want to say by way of introduction is that I don't come to this work as a scientist. I'm not a geographer. I'm not a geologist. I'm not an earth scientist of some kind. But as a young man, I traveled all across this country on different road trips, sometimes hitchhiking. And I fell in love with the unique personality of the different regions, the incredible diversity that makes up this continent, from the, you know, the Appalachians up into the Northeast, stretching all the way up into northern Massachusetts, to the desert Southwest and the high plateaus of northern New Mexico and the Rocky Mountains of Colorado, And then, of course, a lot of time I spent in the middle area, Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota. Such extraordinary wealth of ecological character lives in this continent. And I noticed that I felt like a different person in each of these places. It was like different potentialities of my being expressed themselves when I would be in different landscapes. And this called forth in me a passion to gain a deeper understanding of North America. What lives here? What's working? And this passion finally found some clarity through a few of Rudolf Steiner's statements, but then in particular, through my meeting a Christian community priest named Robert Patterson, who had worked very closely with another Christian community priest named Frederick Benesch. And they had begun to tease out certain mysteries of the North American landscape that made immediate sense to me and that I began to work with. And it's really become one of my central passions is to understand this. And tonight I'll be bringing a good amount of the wisdom of both Reverend Benesch and Reverend Patterson, together with then how I and other colleagues of mine have begun to work with these ideas. So I just wanted to give you that little bit of background, and I'm going to share my screen now. So I always like to start this presentation. Whoops, let's see if I can get my, yeah, having that problem again, Andrew, with the getting it to advance.
If you, I think there's these little arrows down at the bottom. If you can get one of those to work, then you'll, it'll keep working.
Oh.
Yeah, there you go.
There we go.
And now you're down, you're just,
oh, okay, nice.
Page down will work.
Got it, thank you. I always like to start with this image because when we see the image of the Earth from outer space, we know what a powerful impact this had when it first appeared. I think it was in the 1970s. We get a kind of glimpse of the Earth as a living organism, as a living, multifaceted being. And I just want to kind of remind us of that, because to enter into questions of geography, we have to work with abstractions like this, right? You can see if we toggle back and forth here a little, the degree to which this is a kind of abstraction. And similarly, we're going to have to work with some concepts this evening that also might seem abstract. But this is part of our mission through spiritual science, is to take hold of abstractions and through living thinking, lift them up and begin to put flesh on the bones. And this is kind of the whole effort here, is that some of these insights that come to us from Rudolf Steiner, from spiritual science, that we can become mobile with them, creative with them, that they can stimulate our imaginative faculties. So that's my whole goal here tonight, is really to stimulate each of our capacity to form a living understanding of the landscape and our place in the landscape. So we're going to use a particular methodology for this, okay? So just as scientists look at the Earth and the world through different lenses, through microscopes and telescopes, in spiritual geography, we look at the Earth through the lens of the human being. And fortunately, I'm going to make the assumption you all have a certain background in spiritual science. So we're going to look, be looking at the Earth through this lens of the threefold human being, which also expresses itself in the soul faculties of thinking, feeling, and willing, and in the life physical bearers of those soul faculties, of the metabolic limb system and the heart-lung system and the nerve sense system. And often, instead of this image of the human being, I'm going to be using an image of a lemniscate, because the lemniscate captures this quality of dynamic polarity that lives between thinking and willing and between metabolic and nerve sense. A dynamic polarity that is harmonized by the heart lung system. And it's important to remember that this heart is not simply harmonizing the thinking and the willing. The heart is a higher synthesis of thinking and willing, of nerve sense and metabolic limb system. The heart itself is both a sense organ for the pulse, for the circulation of the blood, and a will organ that is able to energize that pulse. The heart is like an image of something of our future humanity that we need to learn how to synthesize and raise to a higher level the polaric nature of our being. I wanted to share that again as a backdrop. So we're going to look at the whole earth for a moment, again, in this abstract form, with this image of the human over it. And we're going to see if there's some wisdom that just begins to show up at a very macro level. And of course, just to say, we could also look at the earth this way. And we will actually, in the next webinar, have recourse to look through this. We could also take this view and this view. Each of these reveal different aspects of the earth. And it's important when we're trying to understand the earth that we look from multiple perspectives, that we try to see the language of the earth from multiple perspectives. But we're going to start here because it's so foundational. And what can we see if we look at a macro picture in this way? Is there some truth to this? Well, what we can see is that the lands of the East do indeed have a connection to human origins. Whether we're speaking of China or Japan or Korea, or whether we're looking at India and Tibet or even the Middle East, we're dealing with cultures that are connected to the origins of humanity, to when humanity first came down to the earth following the destruction of Atlantis. They're connected to these memories of birth. And this is connected to the human head in the sense that we have a head because we have been born out of the whole cosmos. And we know that the whole cosmos is imprinted onto our brain at the moment of birth. Perhaps you can see that there is a real relationship between the East and the human head. And polaric to that, we have the limbs. And this North American continent, actually the Western Hemisphere altogether, is connected to the limb nature of the human being. And this much smaller landmass here in the middle, the European lands, are actually connected to this task of the heart organ, the mediating heart organ. Again, this is a picture Rudolf Steiner gave again and again in terms of geopolitical issues, the challenge for Europe of harmonizing East and West. So we could say the East is connected to origins and the West from a certain perspective to destinations. We even see this in the fact that the first post-Atlantean epoch is in ancient India, and the last post-Atlantean epoch is destined to be in the Americas. Origins and destinations. And one way we can think about this, one way we can see it culturally, is in the relationship to the cow in India versus the relationship of the buffalo for the Native American people on this continent. So for certain spiritual streams in India, the cow is sacred. And this means we do not eat the cow. We do not kill the cow. We can receive milk from the cow, but we do not slay it. Now, the buffalo is equally sacred for the indigenous people on this continent. But this meant, yes, they hunted the buffalo. They ate the buffalo. They used every single part of the buffalo, but in a sacred manner. So you can see here the difference that, again, in the East, there's a calling to protect the pre-earthly portals, the pathways of birth to the spiritual world. You could even say the maternal element. Whereas in the West, we have this calling to take hold of the material world and to reach the spirit through the material world, through working with the material world in a sacred way. So again, we have a connection in the East to the mysteries of birth. In the West, we could say to the mysteries of death. We could also connect this to what Rudolf Steiner called the shepherds and the magi. So the magi are related to a descending stream of inspiration, of revelation, in which they had to carry. They're connected to a carrying of a prophecy of the birth of the Christ being for thousands of years, a kind of faithfulness to carry out this mission. Whereas the shepherds, Rudolf Steiner tells us, had a kind of intuition through their limbs of what would take place at the mystery of Golgotha. They felt already the earth like leaping for joy that the Christ being would descend and unite his being with the whole life of the earth. So in the shepherds, we have this revelation through the limbs, an upward gesture of resurrection power. So different from the faithful, sacrificing, descending path of the Magi. And of course, these two streams are also connected to the working of Lucifer and Ahriman. Lucifer consistently seeks to tempt the East toward an abandonment of the path of earthly evolution into matter. And so we could characterize that as this concept, the material world is Maya. Whereas in the West, very classically, we have the working of Ahriman, and we can see this in a certain way, a tendency in our culture to think spirit is Maya. These are just classical gestures that I'm pointing to now. We can talk about the superphysical forces in the East. And in the West, we don't only talking about matter, we're talking about submaterial forces. The West is really the doorway through which humanity comes into contact with electricity and electromagnetism, radioactivity. This is part of the destiny of the West. Now, I want to just say a couple of words about what Rudolf Steiner has said about the relationship of the electromagnetic forces to the North-South mountain ranges. So basically, the indication is that one reason the electromagnetic forces are so strong in the West is because of the North-South mountain range. But we can take a little bit of a larger view of this, okay? So the way I've come to see this is that the astral eye forces of the Earth move in an east-west, west-east direction. They are connected to this. We can see this in the movement of the post-Atlantean civilizations moving gradually from east to west. Whereas the physical etheric forces, the forces that form the physical world and bring to birth physicality, physical organisms, these work in a north-south directionality. And what this means is that the astral and eye forces, from a certain perspective, if I use an astrological term, they are exalted in the northern hemisphere and also in the eastern hemisphere, where we have an east-west tendency of the mountain ranges. Whereas the physical etheric forces, they are exalted in the south and then in the west, in the western hemisphere, where we have the north-south mountain ranges. And you'll see this will show up as we begin to look more carefully at North America. I'm just trying to lay a ground now, kind of a big picture. Before we go on to look at North America, I just want to touch on these two streams that come to birth in Europe after the mystery of Golgotha, the Grail stream and the Arthurian stream. These are like the carriers, the Magi stream metamorphoses into the Grail stream. And the Shepherd stream metamorphoses into this Arthurian stream. So we have two spiritual impulses that have very different tasks. This Grail stream created sanctuaries hidden away from the rest of humanity where they could commune with the higher members of Christ's being, with the body and blood of Christ that had been carried faithfully again by those who had been present at the mystery of Golgotha, by those who had collected his blood and touched his body. The Arthurian stream, on the other hand, still had a connection to the working of Christ in the sun sphere. And they were filled with a certain pagan might, which gave them to will to travel throughout Europe on knightly deeds, to tame the landscape, to purify the landscape as a preparation for European civilization. So I just want to point to these because these will show up again as we look at North America. And I just want to remind you that it was then the task of Parsifal to unite these two streams. Parsifal was rejected by both the Arthurian stream and the Grail stream initially because his mission was to unite them and then to lay the foundation for what became European civilization. This is beautifully described by Walter Johannes Stein in his books about how Parsifal and Parsifal's son Lohengrin really brought the city culture, the culture of the city, to Europe, which has had such a powerful influence through history. So we're now finally going to turn our attention to North America. And what we have to remember is that, well, let me say two things. Everything I've just shared so far is more or less known from the works of Rudolf Steiner. I've just given you a quick overview. Unfortunately, as important as all of that is, I would say it's insufficient for our task in North America. We actually have to understand North America at a much deeper level. We have to take these indications of Rudolf Steiner and work them at a level of greater detail. And it's important to remember that these principles I'm giving of East and West and Center, they live in every landscape. They live in every person, in every region. They're not just true at this macro level. So one way we could draw this is we could say, yeah, there's also a dynamic polarity in each side of this lemniscate and within each side of that lemniscate and with each side of that lemniscate. Okay, so when we look then at North America, we can start again with this image to try to understand North America. And we can say, is there any reality to this? And I would say, well, yes, there is some reality because look, the origins of our current culture lie on the east. They lie in the East Coast, where Columbus, the Mayflower, where these journeys ultimately landed, is in the east. It is an origin point. And even if we look toward the indigenous people, we learn from Rudolf Steiner that they were a stream that came from Atlantis. So they also moved from east to west into North America, at least some of the indigenous people. I don't think we can originate all of them in Atlantis in that same way. But we do have a kind of origin place. And if I were to describe this for you a little more experientially, you know, when we're in the Northeast, let's just say, just to give an example, and we're in these mountain ranges, offshoots of the Appalachians, we're in these valleys, We feel ourselves in a place that actually many Central Europeans feel at home. Also, this is also an origin quality that there's a little bit of a European landscape on the East Coast. And there's a lot of granite there. So when we are in the Northeast, we can feel very well situated on the earth. And this granite strengthens our clarity of thought. And there's also a kind of human scale to the land on the East Coast, a kind of intimacy so that the quality of human individuality can show up there. Almost a kind of intellectual soul sense of independence that shows up in these lands on the East. But when we move to the middle of the country, when we traverse, let's say, from the East to the Middle West, something remarkable happens, and I'm sure you've all experienced it. Maybe you've all experienced it driving from the East into the Middle West. Is that suddenly this sky descends over us, this enormous sky, and it's like our consciousness descends into our hearts. It's a different consciousness that we feel in the Middle West. And it's, I would say, it's archetypally connected to this big sky experience, and I would say to a blue sky experience. And it's also connected then to this incredibly deep soils and the presence of many, many water bodies, many, many rivers and lakes. It's a whole different experience. And this is connected also with the reality of sedimentary rock. You see, this middle of the country was once a great ocean for thousands of years that rose and fell and rose and fell, and it left all these sediments, copper and iron and lead and sandstone and limestone. Again, we see this rhythmic quality connected with the heart and the lung. And then when we move out into these western lands, whether we're talking about the Rocky Mountains or Moab in Utah, the Great Salt Lake, the desert Southwest, suddenly we feel we become a kind of cosmic citizen. We're in the realm of volcanoes, volcanic life. There's something titanic about it. And it's, I would say, the archetype in this region is being there at night and feeling the immensity of the starry sky that we can really only encounter in that same way in the West. So in these Western lands, it's almost like we're in the realm of the first hierarchy, the sacrifice of the thrones. And in the Middle West, we're in the realm of old sun and the radiance of the sun and the sky, the fertility of the earth. And in the Northeast, the East altogether, we're in kind of an old moon landscape from one perspective, where human wisdom really begins to be born. And of course, we see in the East the great centers of learning, our Ivy League colleges, which are a little bit like homes of our Brahmins here in North America. So this is just to give you a little bit of a picture of how we can look at North America through this same lens. We can say thinking, feeling, and willing. Dynamic polarity also here. And we can also relate this through a fourfold lens. Yeah, so we see here Earth, I mentioned the granite quality of solidity we can feel in the East. When we come into the Middle West, we have the Great Lakes, the Mississippi River. We have lakes everywhere in certain parts of the Midwest, right? We're in a realm of water. And in the Rocky Mountains, you might think, well, isn't that Earth? Look at these giant mountains. But where are these mountains thrust up into? They're thrust up into the air. And when we're in the Rocky Mountains and even the desert Southwest, we're actually really connected to the air element. We can feel that. And out here in the far west, we're really dealing with a fire element connected to the whole ring of fire of the Pacific and that region where some people believe the moon left the earth in the Pacific Ocean. And again, these elemental qualities live in every landscape. And it's important to recognize that in our time, these elemental forces are in a state of chaos. The ability of the earth to maintain a harmony of the earth and the air and the water and the fire is gradually dissolving. The elemental beings are being set loose from their usual anchoredness, and they can only find a new harmony through the working of human beings. This is something I don't have more time to go into. It's a big part of the earth healing work that I do here in Viroqua. And I have some talks on my website about earth healing and how this relates to the needs of the elemental kingdom in our time. But just to say, the task in any given region to discern how have the elemental beings worked there historically, where in particular places can we see them working, and to be present for these elemental beings, to work with them, to help them come back into harmony. This is a significant task for our time. Now, we can also look at North America through this lens. And when we look at through this lens, we can see that indeed in the South is a kind of metabolic limb system. Yeah, everything becomes warm. We think of, well, a place like New Orleans, for example, it's just sort of floating on water like a lily. There is a metabolic quality down into the South. And again, we have a heart-lung system along the middle of the continent. And as we come up into this region of lakes and enormous water, we have a nerve sense system. We could, in a certain way, connect a lake altogether with our nerve sense system, with the quality of stillness and reflection. Whereas a river, the rivers are connected to our feeling life. And the oceans, of which the Gulf of Mexico is an organ of the Atlantic Ocean, a very powerful organ, is connected to the metabolic limb system. So, yes. So, what we see here, again, at this time, is that the heart forces of the landscape are weak. They've been weakened all over the world. The capacity of the forces of resilience and harmonization in the land and in the human being has been weakened. So we see this, for example, in tornado activity in the Midwest. A tornado, I've had a friend describe as a kind of heart attack in a region. The capacity of the Midwest to harmonize the cold fronts from the north and the warm fronts from the south has been diminished. It's been diminished through what's been done ecologically. But also, we could say the immense polarization we see in our continent socially is connected to this weakening of the heart forces, and it's connected to a task to build up the healthy heart forces of this continent. Now, one thing that Reverend Benish and Reverend Patterson often spoke about that I want to touch on, why it is so challenging for this heart organ of America to be healthy. They often spoke of a kind of weakness, actually, in the heart organ of America. And so, what I have here is an image of something that scientists have discovered by sending their microwaves down deep into the earth. And what they've discovered is something they call a failed rift zone. So when they first discovered it, they thought it was just this form here. Now they've discovered there's all these other offshoots to this. And basically, what is a failed rift zone? Well, what the scientists say is that the American continent tried to break in half at one point. It was in the process of splitting apart. And for some reason, from a scientific standpoint, it stopped. It didn't split apart. But we still have the remnants deep beneath the earth of this tendency of this continent that wants to split apart in two. And one of the most notable remnants of this splitting apart is the New Madrid Fault. I don't know how many of you are aware of the New Madrid Fault, but it is actually the most dangerous fault in all of North America. It lies right here, the border region of Missouri and Arkansas and Tennessee and Kentucky. And the last time there was a major earthquake in New Madrid, this was in 1811, 1812, the Mississippi River ran backwards. It rang church bells in Boston. Thank God, at that time, there was very few people living in the middle of the country. So it caused very little damage. But that gives you a picture of how dangerous this fault is. And it also gives you a picture of the challenge of the heart organ on this continent. It's actually known that the West Coast is rising and the East Coast is sinking. You see, and so we have a question. Can the center hold? Can a heart culture be cultivated here in North America? And this task is made all the more important since the end of World War I, where Rudolf Steiner said the mission of Europe had to be transferred to North America because of the way World War I ended. We have had to pick up a kind of heart task of Central Europe here. And now we're facing this question, can we in some way accomplish that? This is a question. Can we accomplish it both culturally and also ecologically? So this is where Dr. Benesch also brought forward some extraordinary pictures, not only of the challenge we face here, but also of an incredibly powerful source of inspiration and healing that lives on this landscape. And what I want to do is now kind of unfold this picture that comes both from Reverend Patterson and Reverend Benesch, and then add some of my own experiences to this picture. But what they point to is the great significance, the enormous significance of the three great water bodies in this central region of North America. The Great Lakes, of course, really the largest collection of freshwater lakes in the world. This map shows the drainage basins, because it's important to remember that the Great Lakes drain north and east. Okay, water flows in and it ultimately circulates out to the north and east. An enormous wealth of life forces on this continent. Dr. Benesch actually saw the Great Lakes as a sevenfold organism. We don't have really time to go into this tonight, but I thought you'd be interested in this. And interestingly enough, he connects Little Lake St. Clair, this little heart-shaped lake next to Detroit. He considers that to be the Sun Lake. But the second great water body is the Mississippi River and her tributaries. Look at this organ on our continent. This is, again, the drainage basins, this enormous river basin stretching all the way out into Colorado, Wyoming, Cincinnati. It's just stunning. And the third most significant water body is the Gulf of Mexico. So what Dr. Benesch came to through his travels and his experiences is something that I've lived with for many years now, and I want to try to give you a picture of it. Okay, so what he said, this is a map of the Gulf Stream. Okay, so down here on the left, maybe you can see the outlines of North America. So the Gulf of Mexico sends out to the east towards Europe and Africa this extraordinary river of warmth. All the climate of Europe is actually dependent on this incredible stream of warm water that flows to the north and to the east. And now, Reverend Benesch says, look, we know from Rudolf Steiner's work that wherever you have a stream of water flowing one direction, you have a reverse stream of etheric forces flowing the other direction. This is something you can explore where you live. It's a very, very important insight. And what Benesch comes to is this experience that the christened etheric forces associated with the Arthurian stream and the Grail stream flow back along the Gulf Stream into North America. And one of these streams, the Arthurian streams, flows back along the St. Lawrence Seaway into the Great Lakes and radiates out there. And another stream of christened etheric forces has its origin in the Grail Stream, flows down and then up the Mississippi River and radiates its forces up into North America. This is a picture that they bring. And I'd like you to just hear a little bit of Reverend Benesch's voice for a moment, how he describes this. So he says, the North American has taken over an interesting concept. This is the concept of sky. With this, he does not mean the starry firmament, but he understands with this concept sky that heaven, which the sun irradiates the air, in which the clouds arise and move and disappear, in which the turbidity arises and clarity descends. In other words, the whole realm of the atmosphere, that which works from above to below, the actual polarity to those forces that work from below upward. So Benesch was very interested. He could perceive that there was thrusting up in North America a kind of aromatic current that tended to take hold of human souls. But then he said, in the air element, actually, in the sky, there lives something completely different that descends from above into the American soul. And this is kind of the source of a certain kind of idealism, an optimism that lives in the American soul. But he also connects us to these great water bodies. He says, this light is reflected by these mighty lakes, is thrown back upon itself, and therefore carries a very delicate shimmer of spirituality even into the finest physical processes. It is not only the physical light, but a very finely spiritualizing, supersensible aspect of the light that works into visibility, into the interweaving character of the light. And this sky, this light, is that to which the American looks up. So again, he's pointing to the fact that there's something that meets us in the we could say the realm of Aquarius, for those of you who are astrologers, this realm of the air and the light that is really the future promise of America. And now another extraordinary quote from Reverend Benesch. I may mention a remarkable statement by Rudolf Steiner in this connection. This says that the rain out of anthroposophical thoughts and forces, the spiritual etheric spreading out in the whole American continent, has its center point. This was the unexpected thunderclap just in Chicago. One can only understand this when one realizes, even in a tentative way, how the light works in this region of the Great Lakes, how the light influences come together rightly in this region, and from there gradually spread out in a harmonizing way over the entire continent. Okay, so what's he saying here? Apparently, this was certainly not in a lecture, but apparently a group of people were having a conversation with Rudolf Steiner one day, and he indicates that there's a kind of vortex of forces that ray out across North America that hold the promise of anthroposophy. And Dr. Benesch looks into this. Sorry, I sometimes call him doctor. I think he was also had a PhD. He looks into this and he comes to the conclusion that this is connected to this weaving of the light forces that come and the etheric forces that come up the Mississippi that descend into the Great Lakes and then unite and form a kind of chalice. I mean, this chalice, we can see so clearly the Mississippi rivers and its tributaries form literally a chalice form. And these Great Lakes we can picture as a kind of host resting in this chalice. We can also, I wanted to just say something. This is a remarkable image of the North Atlantic current, the Gulf Stream. Just to say what I think Benesch was seeing was more complicated. I've looked into this question of the Gulf Stream. I mean, talk about a heart organ. Look at this. But I believe what Benesch is experiencing is actually more complicated. But there is no question in my mind that we have this meeting of a kind of grail-bearing element from the south and a kind of that forms a kind of chalice and a kind of sun host that descends into this. And if we had time today, we could talk a little bit more about that complexity, but I was worried about having enough time. So here's another imaginative way to think about it. Okay, so we could think now in a sevenfold way that this Gulf of Mexico is a kind of lunar chakra. Right, the etheric, our etheric body is tied into our lunar chakra and rejuvenates and energizes our whole body through its connection to that chakra. And we just think of the incredible life forces sent out to Europe from the Gulf of Mexico. We can think of this meeting of the Mississippi River and the Great Lakes and this interweaving light as a kind of solar chakra on the continent. And then as we go north up toward Hudson Bay, we come into, just say, the upper chakras. I'm still kind of studying this. I'm fortunately having an opportunity to spend some time in Canada. And I think this imagination is very real. And so if we think of these three elements, we think of the idea that there's that the being of anthroposophy is kind of centered in these three realms. Then we could picture this as the woman clothed with the sun who stands on the moon. She has a halo of stars around her head, and she's bearing a child. She's bearing the higher self of humanity. And this, I would like to say, this is the great potential source of inspiration for our work here on this continent. That there is this woman clothed with the sun inviting us to cultivate these new heart forces that we need to carry out the work, the deeds that we need to carry out. There's this passage. I encourage you to look at the passage from chapter 12 of the book of Revelation. Now, I don't have time today. Well, let me just say, here's another way we can think about it. We can think about the soul forces in a north-south direction, the sentient soul forces in the south. I think we can see this in the southern draw, this connection to the sentient soul in the Midwest, this center of the continent, a connection to the intellectual soul. And as we come up into the upper Midwest, into Canada, think of the cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul, we have something of a consciousness soul quality, and descending into this, I would say, quality of the spirit self. So just another way of imagining this woman clothed with the sun. But what I don't, oh yeah. So Andrew, I have a question about time to make some decisions about what to cover and not cover. How am I doing? How much time do I have left?
Well, by the clock, you've got about 8 minutes because I used up 5 of your minutes for the introduction.
Okay, that's great. So I'm going to, yeah, I've got a few more slides. I just want to point to another remarkable quote from Rudolf Steiner about America in this light. So he says, this is what is so interesting. In America, materialism is truly rampant, and yet it is on its way to the spirit. When a European becomes a materialist, his or her human element dies. Americans, however, are young materialists. Actually, all children are materialists, and they grow up to what is not materialism. And so crude American materialism will develop directly into something spiritual. And this will come to pass when the sun stands in the sign of Aquarius. Now, this is so interesting because most of us think when the sun stands in the sign of Aquarius, this is when the sixth cultural epoch will emerge, which is centered in, according to Rudolf Steiner, in Russia, in the Slavic world. Now, Rudolf Steiner is telling us here that actually this awakening will happen all over the world, including in America. And what is so interesting about this is a few years ago, I had a meeting with Brian Gray. Some of you, I'm sure, know Brian Gray. He's made the effort to identify how the zodiac is imprinted onto the earth. So there is this indication from Rudolf Steiner, just as at birth, the zodiac's imprinted onto our head, there's a certain moment in earth evolution when the whole zodiac is imprinted on the earth. And Brian has spent decades trying to discern this, and he's come to certain conclusions. I wish I had a better picture from Brian, but just take a moment. I don't know if you can just barely see the outlines of North America here. These are three constellations. This one covers a portion of the East Coast, and that is Pisces. Right here in the middle of the country, the whole realm I've been talking about is Aquarius. And here on the West Coast is Capricorn, the ultimate future mission of America connected to the forces of Capricorn, the seventh post-Atlantean epoch. So here again, I think we see a kind of confirmation of the Aquarian element, this inspiration of the woman clothed with the sun that we can experience in the weaving of the clouds and the air, particularly in the central region, but then radiating out over the whole continent. Now, I don't have time to go into all of the forces, you could say, working against this awakening and this cooperation with the woman clothed with the sun. We could call them the anti-grail, the anti-Arthurian forces. But I do want to point to one of these, which I consider to be the kind of metamorphosis of the anti-grail impulses of the what are sometimes called the Mexican mysteries. I would call them the Ahrimanic mysteries of ancient Mexico. And this lives and works in the industrial agriculture impulse. And all we have to do is think about how the industrialization of agriculture has completely decimated, in the first place, the heartland of North America, how it has denuded the landscape, and what that has done to the regulating heart forces of the land, and also what it's done to the culture, the heart culture. But Rudolf Steiner points out in ancient Mexico, the mysteries were not only associated with tearing out the heart, but tearing out of the stomach. Well, think about then the effect of these massive quantities of food being raised in these depleted soils in North America, now being shipped all over the world. It's also interesting to think that these agricultural chemicals being used on the land have resulted in something called the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. These pour down the Mississippi River and have created a dead zone. So here we see a kind of tearing out of the metabolic limb organ of our continent, the Gulf of Mexico. And I'm pointing to this because I'm going to speak more about agriculture in the next webinar. I believe that agriculture is really, from a certain perspective, the foundation for the development of a new mechanical occultism. It's intimately related. And I'll speak about that next time. But I want to close by simply saying, look, in Europe, Parzival had to unite the Grail and Arthurian stream in order to bring a new civilizational impulse to Europe. Now, to the degree these pictures I've shared are true, we have a natural weaving together of these two streams. They flow together and create this extraordinary vortex of forces. But there's some new Parzival deed that's needed. You could call it a Parzival deed. Some of you might want to call it a Vidar deed. Or we could also call it a new Vitzli Putzli deed. Because it's not enough for this woman clothed with the sun to be a promise of a spiritual awakening of America in the future. No, we have deeds to carry out on this continent now and in the coming decades. Mighty deeds connected to the taming of the Ahrimonic element, the transforming of the Ahrimonic element. This is the north window, Rudolf Steiner's drawing for the north window. I think it's sometimes called the pink window. This depicts in the center the meeting of the human being with the etheric Christ through the mediary of the natural world. On the left, we have a picture of the Christ redeeming and transforming Lucifer. And on the right, we have a picture of the Christ taming, transforming the being of Ahriman. What is necessary? What capacities, what beings, what inspirations do we need to form a Michaelic community in the coming years that we can carry out a mighty deed for the future of civilization here? We can see the degree to which our continent wants to be completely torn in half, politically, ecologically, socially. And I just want to close by saying that there's a lot of inspiration we have to draw on for these deeds. There's been so many mighty figures, Michaelic figures in North America. Whether we think again of the deed of Vitzli Putzli, again, if you're not familiar with this imagination, Rudolf Steiner tells us that Vitzli Putzli defeated a black magician in ancient Mexico at the time of Christ. That black magician wanted to bring about certain earth changes that would have disrupted the potential of the mystery of Golgotha. This is an enormous Christ deed on this continent. Or whether we think of the peacemaker, the story of Hiawatha and Denagawita and their deeds to form the Iroquois conspiracy, or whether we think of White Buffalo Calf Woman who came to the Lakota people, like you could say a kind of emissary of this woman clothed with the sun and brought them the seven sacred rites of the Siouan people. So many incredible deeds that we can build on, the deeds of the founding fathers, the deeds of the transcendentalists of Abraham Lincoln, George Washington Carver, Martin Luther King, John Muir. We could go on and on. The legacy is there. We have a history of courageous deeds. The question is, what does this deed look like for us, for now, and for the coming years? How do we carry out these deeds as a community, inspired by these earlier deeds? But clearly, what needs to happen is something that will take a completely and utterly unique form. This is a topic I will take up in the next webinar. Again, where we'll look toward the beings, the forces that we need to tap for this deed. So I'll stop there. Andrew, thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Robert. We'll take questions, but I'm just, you know, so many of the things you said really struck a chord deep in me. And I know many of us hear sort of the ugly American side. And to me, it's always been something important to try to tell the rest of the world, you know, the folk spirit of America offered our land, offered its people up for sacrifice for the place where Ahriman, who needed to incarnate. So in what you brought just resonated so deeply with much of what I have felt about America and its role in human and cosmic evolution. So I'm going to open the floor here to questions. You can...
Shall I stop sharing my screen then?
You can. Yeah, probably if anybody asks for something from your talk, we can go back to it, but
yeah. Okay.
So use either the chat or the Q&A. The Q&A is better to use, so I won't miss your thought if your question, if you post it on chat, I might miss it because other things are going up there. And to get things started, I'm going to ask you a question, Robert.
Yes.
And it has to do with what you just mentioned about Bitsley Putsley and this black magician. It appears in historical analysis, not necessarily record, of the Mayan people, that the cities were abandoned at a certain time all across the Mayan, whatever you want to call it, empire. And it seems roughly at the same time of Bitsley Putsley. Do you think there's some connection? Is it possibly because in order to stop the black magic, there was a movement to out of the cities to just return to the land?
Well, I'm not a historian, especially of Central America. But what I can say this, Andrew, there's a very special place in Wisconsin called Aztalan. And it has been built in the character of these mound cities, okay, such as we have outside St. Louis and in other places of North America. So we have a very different indigenous impulse that built these whole cities and mounded up earth and created earth temples and stepped temples. It's a completely different stream in North America.
Right.
And what's interesting to me is if you go to Cahokia, and again, this is at a later phase, but in Cahokia, which is outside St. Louis, you definitely at a certain point had a tradition of human sacrifice take place there in Cahokia. Then if you spend time in Aztalan, I have the impression of extraordinary purity in this place. And I believe there were groups of people continually leaving and trying to form outposts independent of this Black magical influence. And even the indigenous tribes of the North, people often wonder, well, why don't they have the same cosmological knowledge that the indigenous people who built these mound cities, I'm sorry, I can't remember the technical term for them, but the northern tribes do not have the same cosmological knowledge, or to the degree they have it, it's completely hidden. And this, I believe, has to do with the fact that the corruption of cosmological knowledge in the South. And so this whole history, I think, is yet to be fully told of the relationship here. I think the northern tribes really had a mission to purify, and kind of like the relationship of the Jews to the pagans, where the Jews separated from the pagan peoples because they were becoming corrupt. And I think we see something similar with the Native American tribes of the North.
Wow. Very interesting. And I must admit, just as a comment, I very much appreciated what you brought about the social polarization having a perhaps reflection or influence on the further polarization of our weather. It's a fascinating thing to look into, and you know, and the sort of overall question of what does social culture have to do with the earth, you know, and you know, and things like weather or volcanoes, and
totally.
Yeah.
An intimate connection, I'll just say, in my experience, much bigger connection than we tend to attribute.
I one question is showing up. I will ask it in just a second. But one other interesting phenomena is Yellowstone and the size of the volcano there. And I have read something when I was out there, some plaque, and my memory might not be quite right, but it said it's deemed to be the largest volcano on the earth, and that it's multiple millennia of activity is how the Midwest got all of the soil properties, because the dust where the winds kept moving the dust coming out of the volcano eastward, and it would land and the plants would grow up through it, the grasses and so on, and constantly made soil that was, when
yeah.
the European settlers came, they had never seen soil so incredibly vital and so deep. It was many, many feet deep.
Well, certainly in the West, I mean, you know, we have the most extraordinary fruit growing regions in the West, and this is intimately connected to the volcanic quality of the soil. And again, we can see the fruits are connected to the fire element. We have the volcanic ash in the soil, and it has this effect on the formation of beautiful and flavorful fruits.
Yeah.
This fire region of the far West, as I was showing, of North America.
Well, here's a question. What are some of the differences in culture between Eastern and Western North America? Do you notice that support? Oh, sorry. Let me try this again. What are some of the differences in culture between Eastern and Western North America that you notice that support the idea of consciousness moving from East to West?
Well, first of all, if you've lived in these different regions, the presence of history on the East Coast is just so much stronger, whether that's through architecture or just the culture there holds a connection to history. That's, I mean, when you go west, it's still there, but you have to look for it. And the architecture is much more modern. So you're not standing on any kind of historical legacy in the same way when you're on the west. If anything, when you're in California, Oregon, Washington, in particular, you're under an influence from the Far East. There's a whole different influence that's streaming in, right? This fire quality is connected to this huge element of the Pacific. And I would say there's a fire quality that moves from west to east, something totally different. We didn't have time to go into that. But on the East Coast, there's still a very strong legacy of the European past and of the traditions. There's a reason why, Haight-Ashbury in the 60s, not that the 60s revolution didn't take place on the East Coast. We certainly had Woodstock, et cetera, but it came to its flowering in this blossom realm of the West, right? There's a freedom from tradition. There's a kind of natural cosmic consciousness, if you will.
I don't know.
Hopefully that helps. It's hard for me to answer questions when I can't see the face of the person asking them. But
that's the problem with these webinars.
Doing my best here. I feel a little too distant from all of you, but okay. Doing my best.
Another question. How may we come together in community with these cultural impulses?
Well, that's a big question. So it's a very big question. This is the thing. If we were together, I was doing a workshop with all of you, we would do all kinds of community building exercises together. We could create a mandala of the whole earth and bring into that mandala poetry and singing and our biographical experiences of the earth in different places. There's so many things that can be done to weave community and bring into that community the elemental quality of different places of the earth and of different artistic streams. But I will mention one thing that I think is really important for this deed that I've been talking about. So I brought the picture of the Magi and the shepherds, and we know that this polarity, Rudolf Steiner brought a lot about the polarity within the anthroposophical movement of the old souls and the young souls, or the Platonists and the Aristotelians. This is all connected. The fact that these different streams are trying to come together, okay? But we find this polarity throughout the world. And what I would say is, if we look at the movement of Michaelites globally, right? The worldwide community of people who have incarnated out of the inspiration of Michael. And at this moment in time, the anthroposophical movement kind of represents the Magi stream of the Michael movement, even though within the anthroposophical movement, we have both the Aristotelian and the Platonic, the Grail and the Arthurian. From a bigger perspective, we are like the Magi, who've got this whole historical legacy and traditions coming from Rudolf Steiner. But there's a whole other community of Michaelites around us who are really working out of their limb and heart nature, who are doing the work of Michael without knowing necessarily who Michael is, without knowing all of this cosmological knowledge that we have, but who have this karma, okay? And this is the meeting that I'm particularly interested in, you see, because Lucifer would like to take hold of our Magi community and make us into a sectarian body. Ahriman would like to take hold of our Michaelic brothers out there and just get them to compromise again and again and again their work with Ahrimanic culture. So to me, the question is, how can we build community across this global community of Michaelites? And I think part of that is our task is to recognize the leading Michaelites who are out there right now without necessarily any knowledge of anthroposophy. But if we see them, if we recognize them, they're just incredible. Think of the incredibly courageous individuals who came forward during COVID. Think of the incredibly courageous individuals who have forged the worldwide environmental movement, sustainable agriculture movement, right? We need to build those kind of bridges, as I see it, at least supersensibly. We need to recognize the community of Michaelites. But it's also true that to do that work, we need to come together within our own community and learn how to see each other and appreciate one another, and how to create vessels that higher beings can dwell in. This is the task. The work can't be done by us as individuals now. It has to be done by us as a community. So I don't know in this brief moment that there's a lot more.
Right. Well, that's good. We have a question here that follows from what you were just saying about how to bring about in the heartland that, get it started, what can lead to this future of what America needs to do, assuming that it's supposed to come from the heartland.
Well, I just want to say the heartland is in each of us. And every region has its heartland. Every community has its heartland. Every farm has this dynamic polarity and it has its heart space. So at a macro level, it's true. Just as Europe has a certain mission in the macro picture, so the heartland has a certain mission. But the heart is everywhere, and we can each cultivate our heart, build community. I mean, we're trying here in Viroqua in many ways to do this work. I think that the knowledge of social threefolding, of mechanical occultism, of agriculture, food and agriculture, associative economics, we need to find ways to become active as communities. And that, I think, is the key. I don't know what else I really can say about it right now, especially, again, without seeing the person asking this question.
Right. Well, I'm sorry to throw another one from a person that you can't see, but
that's okay.
Could you relate some of this work to the inner layers of the earth and what America's role is with that?
Well, I mean, just to say the obvious in a way that these inner layers of the earth are connected to the lower selves of human beings. Ahriman is really the incarnation of Ahriman. We're really talking about the incarnation of the collective lower self of human beings. This is why the incarnation of Ahriman is so important. This is our opportunity to come to terms with our collective shadow. And our collective shadow is held and nurtured by certain forces of evil that work through the subterranean layers of the earth. But those subterranean layers are not only conduits of evil, right? The Christ being dwells within the earth. So this is even why we really shouldn't reject Ahriman or reject our own lower self. The question is one of recognition and transformation. And this is a particular gift, I would say, of the being of Uriel that I'll be talking about next time. That Uriel, as I see it, is the guiding being of North America. You see, Rudolf Steiner tells us we have a backward archive here. And that's true. But we have more than a backward archive. We have the Archangel Uriel, who is like the true spirit of the West. And Uriel is particularly interested in helping us to see the working of our own lower selves, to see how the subterranean spheres thrust up into our consciousness and diminish our consciousness and distort our soul forces. And so this, I think, is really a big part of the work, is that the intensity of our efforts at moral development here in America have to really be heightened. There's a very high bar that's been set for us to be able to do the work of mechanical occultism associated with incredible strengthening of our moral capacities.
Right. Well, there's a question here about Ahriman's coming incarnation. Some people say he's maybe already as a boy or young adult. But the question is, this transformation of materialism into a spirituality that can meet this Ahrimanic incarnation. And if you can comment on how that can come about, because I think the person's feeling like it can't.
So how this American materialism transforms
into a spirituality, right, that can meet Ahriman when he incarnates here.
Well, it's a great question. It's something to do with our willingness to keep opening ourselves to what modern materialism is thrusting forward into culture. So in some level, it's so dark and wicked, you could say, yeah. But on another level, we have to get into the belly of the beast. We have to be willing to enter into it. What's actually working in artificial intelligence? How is that actually possible with chat? What's it called, Andrew? Chat?
Not GPT. Yeah.
GPT. It's not enough to reject these phenomena because, as I see it, unless we can untangle the thread in these labyrinths, I don't know that we'll have the capacity to confront Ahriman on his turf, so to speak. So this is the delicate balance between, being thrust too deeply into modern materialism, embracing it all, surrounding ourselves with technology, saying it's all good, and the other polarity, which is rejecting it, forming our little islands of culture. We need to be able, as I see it, to engage and keep deepening. And I mean, I think of, I don't know if Bronco's on the call, but I think of Bronco's amazing work on the human heart, which partakes of...
That's Bronco First, F-U-R-S-T,
yes,
folks.
Bronco First. Bronco said he was going to join this webinar, but Bronco's drawing from research, right? He's not just bringing forward spiritual scientific insights. He's drawing on contemporary research. I mean, the discovery that the heart is not a pump is emergent in the research community right now. Stephen Talbot is writing about this all the time for the Nature Institute. The discovery of the epigenetic nature of the biological world, it's happening.
It is.
So this movement of the sciences and of technology toward the spiritual is happening. The question is, it needs it needs anthroposophical participation, because the demonic forces would like to just put a subtle twist in here to these insights to keep it bound or to take it into kind of a luciferic realm. This is why, like, we need to be working with our colleagues. The America is just full of extraordinary Michaelic souls. We're like a tiny enzyme in there, but we need to participate. We need to be part of these movements. That's all I can say.
Well, we've used up all of our time allotted for this. If you didn't get your question answered tonight, bring it next week. We will be here again. Same time, same station, as they used to say on TV. And Robert, I want to thank you so much for bringing what you have here tonight, but more so for all the work that you've done for spiritual science in North America. And I hope all of you on the call here have a taste for what Robert has done, this dedication to the work. So I hope all of you can join again next week. Robert has just put his website and email up for those who might want to contact him in between now or after next week. So thank you, Robert, with a lot of gratitude and a lot of heart warmth. Thank you so much for being here tonight.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, everyone. Big, big hug to all of you. And looking forward to seeing some of you next week.